The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, you're just getting back from New York. You were on a roundtable discussion, I think they call it Breakfast Without Borders, that was sponsored by The Economist magazine, specifically talking about worldwide competition for commodities.
Kevin, certainly China factors into that, and that'll be a part of our conversation with Bert Doman today. But, you know, what we did is we looked at sort of a layman's taxonomy for commodities. If you want to classify them in simple terms, you have the commodities which you need, you have the commodities that you want, and then you have sort of a hybrid. The needs are the ags. These are the things that you consume. Agricultural commodities, you must have food. You must have a shirt on your back. You must have shelter. These are the things that allow people to exist. The wants, this ties into your industrial commodities, and that has a very different, almost sort of contingent need. If you have extra money, if you have, you know, a wealth effect, extra disposable income, if you find yourself in a particular development cycle, then you see an increase in demand for these quote-unquote wants, but they're not the necessities of life. Metals, specifically the precious metals, fit sort of a hybrid because you have a small degree of industrial demand, which we've talked about a few weeks ago, jewelry demand, which is 40 to 50% of that market, and then investment or savings demand, which is also a large component, driven by the asset class being non-correlated, being driven by negative real rates, being driven by currency concerns. So that was a part of our conversation, Kevin. It was actually a very, very intriguing panel because we had a gal there who had spent 15 years as an attorney for the Commodity Futures Trading Commission.
That was Susan Irvin, wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. She's now in private practice with Davis Polk in D.C., but she was actually chief counsel of the CFTC's Division of Trading and Markets. She had a lot of things to say about the Dodd-Frank bill and sort of its influence into the derivative space. So that was interesting. Kevin, we had some interesting comments also from Stefan Heck. He's a director with McKinsey & Company. And he was looking more at the elements within the commodity space dealing with sustainability. And, you know, he had an interesting concept in terms of peak energy, not peak oil, but in terms of energy usage, very interesting concepts that were particularly relevant for the CEOs and CFOs of major Fortune 500 companies who are in attendance for this panel discussion.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask, because while you were in New York, of course, you were on Fox Business, and you did several radio and television interviews. But as far as the audience here, this was a closed audience, was it not? This was pretty much CFOs and top-level people. How many were in the audience?
Maybe 50 to 75.
So it was a very exclusive roundtable type of discussion.
Yeah, and it got started out with a conversation with Leo Abruzze. He's the editorial director here in North America for the Economist Intelligence Unit. And he did a great job explaining what the Economist sees as a 2012 prognosis. We think, in his terms, we'll see a decline, and this is very consistent with the IMF's recent report as well as the World Bank's recent report of slowing growth in 2012, a decline, if you will, a move in the direction of recession. And of course, he thinks that's going to be negative for the commodities in the short run. But I think everyone is fairly convinced that China plays the larger role in the commodity space, whether it is short-term, medium-term, or long-term.
Well, and wouldn't you say it is important, again, to delineate the difference between monetary commodity, which is a gold commodity, versus the commodities they're talking about? They're talking about copper. They're talking about aluminum. They're talking about maybe even lumber and some of the other things.
And that's why my comments actually dealt with that sort of commodity classification. It's one thing to paint with a broad brushstroke, but to say, hey, there's a part of this where demand's relatively constant because people still need corn and wheat and rice and the basic staples of life. There's those wants, which are optional. Consumer durables, not everybody's going to go out and buy three new televisions this year. They might have done that last year. They're not going to buy a new toaster oven or a microwave if they've just bought one or if they can't afford one.
Right.
These are optional purchases which do put increased demand pressure on those sort of industrial commodities.
Well, and as China goes, I mean, that has been fueled, like the United States for the last 40 years. The Chinese demand right now has been fueled by just sort of a debt bubble that's been growing, and that can't last.
Well, and this is part of that issue with those industrial or wants, if you want to categorize it as such, metals. You're really dealing with a development cycle. They've been transitioning from a largely agrarian culture to a more industrial culture, And they're also dealing with a major demographic shift from people living in the countryside to, at least their intention is, to bring people into the cities. And that's why they've had these major building projects. So, Kevin, these were some of the highlights from that. Of course, we talked about credit growth and a reversal in credit growth here in the U.S. as well as in the West at this particular conference. But, you know, to look at China, because China really is the 8,000-pound gorilla in the room when it comes to commodities,
right.
We engage a conversation with Burt Doman, because it was very clear to everyone in the room there at the Four Seasons in downtown Manhattan that it was China. I mean, if you're going to talk about commodities, and if you have a prognosis for the commodities market, you have to talk about China.
Well, just like in this family, you've got China bulls and China bears, right? There, you know, there's a bull in the closet, and that's your dad right now. Okay, but you're a China bear right now, at least short term, because you're thinking that there's a slowdown
trend. And I think that's the point to focus on, Kevin, because it is in the short term. I'd say over the next 20 years, I'm a China bull.
Right.
Over the next 20 months, I'm a China bear.
So don't lose money on a long-term bet playing it short.
Yeah, as we approach the end of the Chinese New Year and that February 1st date, we may have a better indication of exactly what the Politburo and the money mandarins in China will be doing to help stimulate the economy and to keep it from coming off the rails, so to say.
Well, let's get Burt Doman on the line.
Well, back with us today is Burt Doman. We've had the conversation many times in the past to cover both technical and fundamental issues. And one of the things that we want to do today is look at China. You know, 2008, we had the global financial crisis, and you know, the subprime market was certainly a part of that. You could call it a U.S.-oriented problem, and then it spread throughout the world. The emerging markets provided liquidity relative to the domestic economies that was truly unprecedented. China had been growing at rates peaking out at about 14.2% in 2007. And, you know, they threw $1 trillion into the market to try to keep things going. And in spite of the $1 trillion intervention, things have declined. The growth rates, while still positive at about 8.9%, are contracting relative to where they were. We can only imagine what the landscape would be like without massive emerging market monetary intervention. But we want to look at 2008 as sort of a foreshadowing to 2012, 2013. And there's two areas that we have grave concern with, and one is Europe and certainly the sovereign debt issue. The other is China, and it's a less noticed issue, but one that we think could have grave ramifications for the global economy. So Burt Doman's with us again today to kind of explore China, some of the things that have led to excess there, and why there could be some major issues coming into 2012. Burt, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, always nice to be with you, David.
Well, as we see it, Burt, one of the problems was that those Chinese stimulus dollars, the $1 trillion that was made available to the market, went primarily into development schemes and infrastructure projects. And there's some issues with that. We're beginning to see them bud, if you will. Maybe you could comment.
Yes. You know, the stimulus in China, and you're so right, this is the same type of stimulus that Japan has tried for the last 22 years. And we know now that this was totally ineffective. You know, the Japanese stock market is still down about 80% from the 1990 high. So building bridges to nowhere, building out of this infrastructure, does not really bring a return on investment. A lot of the bulls on China are talking about that surge of $3.3 trillion, et cetera, et cetera. Therefore, they will not run out of money. What they don't realize is that these surpluses have been invested by the Chinese government in infrastructure, first of all, roads, railroads, bridges, etc. That money is in the ground. It isn't there. They didn't put it under the mattress. They also put a lot of this money into the largest banks in China, which are all owned by the government. And it's estimated by some that the bad loans, loans that are not getting their principal and interest paid, are up to as much as 50% of all loans, okay? So the total bad loans in the system might be as much as $2 trillion. That's also money that's already gone to money heaven. It doesn't exist anymore. So China is really in a bad position right now. Their debt to GDP ratio is as bad as the countries in Europe and as bad as the U.S. They are not the big colossus of the world. They're having big problems. Now, what's happening at the same time is that the Chinese economy is going into recession. And I know that a lot of listeners will say, oh, you're an idiot. You don't know what you're talking about. They're booming. Their economic growth is 9%. That's GDP growth. okay? It is a number coming from the government. GDP growth, what you would advertise, GDP growth is always inflation adjusted. Well, their inflation adjustment is around, I think currently it's about 6%. They take nominal GDP, they deduct 6%, and then they get that 9%. But business people in China and consumers, they will tell you inflation is at minimum 15%. So if they would deduct the 15% from the 15% nominal growth, China's economy right now is at zero growth. If you take a look at manufacturing numbers in China, they're now below 50. If you take a look at the Purchasing Managers Index, it had the biggest decline since the low of the crisis in March of 2009. Okay, so manufacturing in China is already contracting, not expanding. So this whole story of a continuing strong economy in China is total fiction.
It really does have a lot to do with those stimulus dollars and the fact that, you know, as we've seen slowing consumption first in the U.S. and now in the Eurozone, of course there would be an impact into China. But that's largely been papered over by these stimulus measures, and we now have what you would expect. The money's run out, and the question is, will they requeue? Will they spend another trillion?
Yeah, but you see, all of this money cannot go against or eliminate market forces. And we hear the bulls appearing on financial TV, and they always say, oh, the Chinese government, they can control this thing, they can engineer a soft landing. No, they can't. If they were all powerful, in 2008, the Chinese stock market was down about 70%. If the government were so all powerful, would they have allowed a 70% plunge in the Shanghai index? I don't think so. Would they have allowed the greatest destruction of the economic fabric in China? No, they couldn't stop it. It was a global financial crisis. They could not stop it. If you take a look at what's been happening here in the last 6 months in trade in China, exports, the good way to look at exports, find out what's going on, is you look at shipping rates. All the goods produced in China have to be shipped on ships to Europe, to the United States. Well, the shipping rates are down about 60%. Do you think the shipping companies would allow freight rates to decline by 60% if they had a huge amount of business and continuing growth? No. It shows you that these ships are going empty. Okay. So this has been going on now 6 months. It started with the European crisis. The European crisis, the crisis itself, which means the fear that the European banking system would collapse, I think that's going to be eliminated now for a while. That's going to be pushed into the background. It's not going to happen. That long-term repo operation on December 1st in Europe basically eliminates that fear because the European Central Bank said, we will provide an unlimited, and that was their wording, amount of money to the banking system. And that was it. That was the big bazooka. Okay, but now comes the economic crisis, and that means austerity across Europe. That means cutting back expenses, banks cutting back loans, not cutting back, eliminating loans, basically, to the private sector, and that means a big recession. So China is just starting to see the repercussions of a deep recession in Europe, and then comes the deeper recession in the United States.
We look at the impacts to other areas based on slowing or even a collapse in China. You know, we look at commodity prices and, you know, whether it's copper or molybdenum or steel. Talking to producers who are based in Europe but have major production facilities throughout Africa, it would appear that everyone is waiting for this Chinese New Year to get past us. As soon as we get into February, we will know something about the Politburo and their decision, how they will stimulate, if there will be a return to commodity purchases. Otherwise, everyone in the industrial commodity space is palpably afraid of what will happen in terms of total demand. As in the industrial space, you're talking about a country that consumes between 30% on the low side, as high as 56% on the high side, depending on the commodity. But that's a global consumption of these commodities.
Yeah. You see, capital investments in China, it's about 60% of GDP. In the average in industrialized nations, it's 8%. So their capital investments are about 8 times higher. This is the government putting money in. The consumer is still diminishing as a percentage of GDP. About 6 years ago, China said, we're really going to focus on getting the consumer part of the economy moving upward. That time it was 45%.
Yeah, 45%. Now it's 10 points lower.
That's right. It's 34% right now. So it's gone exactly the opposite way of what the government had wanted. Here, once again, is an example that this government is not all-powerful. You know, let's face it. I mean, it's a communist dictatorship. When has a communist dictatorship ever been so efficient in controlling the economy? It just isn't. People forget that.
You know, and I think it was a past conversation we had, Bert, you had mentioned that as an economy comes on stream, as it's going from an underdeveloped state to a developed state, there is a sense in which a command economy can work. But once you get past that sort of catch-up phase, then you do rely on the tenacity, the creativity, the ingenuity that comes from a market-driven economy, not from a command economy. So what we have seen in the last decade or so in terms of growth is in that catch-up phase. Do you feel like that's still a fair comment?
Yeah, exactly. You're so right on that. We did a special report called The Coming China Crisis, 102 pages. It's available on our website. We did that a few months ago. That talks exactly about it. That's one part of the report, is that what we've seen in China is basically the boom has been based on taking Western technology that has taken the West 100 years to develop, and they're getting it given to them. They don't even pay for the technology. You know, it's part, if you want to do business in China, you have to give them the technology free of charge. And this is what's happened. But now they're getting to the point where it is developed. They have caught up, and now they have to depend on their own ingenuity. They are very smart people. But you need a free economy, and you need a democratic form of government for this ingenuity to exert itself. And you don't have that in China yet. I'm sure that someday we will. You know, the genie has come out of the bottle in China, and the government, these older guys that were brought up as communists, they're dying off. So biology is in favor of a freer economy. But they now have to depend more on their own ingenuity, their own inventions, their own technology. That's going to take a while, you know. So everybody agrees that China is, you know, over the next 20 or 30 years, will have tremendous growth. But even in the best of times, you take the year of or the age of the railroad in the United States, investors really didn't make any money on that boom in the railroad business when the railroads were being built out to the West Coast. You know, that whole boom in developing the Western United States, investors, stock market investors really didn't make much money on that.
So, you mentioned Chinese equities, and of course they had a run prior to 2008, a very significant run, and then followed that by a collapse, 65 to 70%. We're still only about halfway to those previous peaks. In other words, the recovery, it's been a non-recovery. It basically hasn't gone anywhere. Is there anything that we should be reflecting on that? You know, there's this idea of decoupling, and, you know, certain writers have said, listen, they're going to lead the charge. They're going to be sort of the largest economy. They surpassed Japan as the number two, and now it's just a question of time before they surpass the U.S. as number one. Can we look at the Shanghai Exchange and say perhaps there's a different story being told?
I think we should not correlate economic activity with stock market. The companies in China are really in a pickle right now. Their profit margins have been squeezed so much that the small and the mid-sized enterprises, the SMEs, aren't even making any money. They cannot get financing from the banks, so they have to. They're forced into these small finance companies, which are really run by the party officials. They're paying 30% to 130% interest on these short-term loans just to keep their business open and to be able to fulfill their contracts. They're in such a profit squeeze. Labor rates have gone up 40% over the last 2 years. That's an incredible increase. Then they've had the increase in raw material prices. These small to mid-sized enterprises are not making money in China. On top of that, many companies in China have made money by speculating in the stock market with their operating cash. That's real nice when the stock market is moving up, but when it's moving down, that kills you. That leads to bankruptcy. That's why we've had so many accounting frauds of Chinese firms. They're doing everything they can to stay alive, so they cheat on their accounting. So what the Shanghai Index is telling you, and it's really in a bear market, that bear market rally we had is over, and it's now the market is going down. It reflects reality. The smart money knows what's really going on underneath the surface.
Well, yeah, they are now the number two economy, but it appears they've got plenty ahead of them. It was once said that if Asia sneezed, the world would feel it. The idea of the Asian contagion going back to the 1990s. What would you think of a second rendition of an Asian contagion? Do you see that as a possibility over the next 24 months?
Yes, you know, David, over the last 3 years, we've heard all the beautiful stories about the China's basically pulling the whole world out of this crisis that we had in 2008 and 2009. Well, that story is reversing as we speak. And so suddenly, all the reasons for buying raw materials and companies that benefit from an economic boom in China, they're going to be out the window. They're like the Caterpillars of the world and the heavy construction machinery and so on. Komatsu, which is the competitor of Caterpillar, the Japanese company, they already reported last week that they're having trouble getting paid from China. So, you know, these are the developers in China. They're going bankrupt, the big developers. They're cutting the rates on their new condominiums by 40% and more just to move them. You've got 60 million apartments, new apartments standing empty. It is absolutely incredible. They have 40 billion square feet of office space under construction. 500 skyscrapers are in construction, not a tenant to be seen. Okay, so this is what China is facing right now. This is not going to be something that will be resolved in a year or two, and it will infect the globe. And our position, that's what we said in the China report, when the China crisis, when it finally becomes recognized, this is going to be a tsunami throughout the financial world.
So, you know, there's similarities to Dubai, where, of course, there's a, you know, virtual ghost town of skyscrapers, gorgeous design, by the way, but all empty. It was very eerie driving through Dubai in 2008 at night and seeing not a single light on. So it's because they hadn't run the wires. Again, the same issue, no tenants. But you're really equating this to saying, yes, when you have a credit boom, it generally is followed up by a credit bust.
Always. And, you know, Ludwig von Mises of the Austrian School of Economics wrote that. And, you know, I showed that slide of his quote, the seminar this weekend. We had a 3-hour seminar, as you know, and you were kind enough to announce it to your own clients. And a number of them were there, and it was really nice meeting them. But we discussed exactly that, all of these apartments. You know, many of these new apartments were built even without bathrooms or without bathroom fixtures. See, in the West, when we have a surplus of condos or houses, eventually they'll be bought, okay? Maybe it'll take 3-4 years. But over there, they can't be bought. In 3 or 4 years, they're going to be falling down. Okay, so this is not something that's durable. They were just built as fast as they could. There was one person at the seminar, he said, just came back from China. He said, we drove literally for several hours on this one highway going out of town and into the countryside. And here were all these buildings, building after building, as far as the eye could see, all brand new apartment buildings. Not one person living in them.
Well, it's certainly a Potemkin village on a grand scale.
Yes.
You've got the idea that certainly there's progress. I mean, I remember going up to the North Korean border when we were in South Korea many years ago, and they have all these buildings just on the other side of the border where the music is playing and they actually turn the lights on. It's an entire city, which is a facade. No one lives there. They want everyone in the South to hear the happy noises and hear the economic activity and see the bright lights at night. And all it is a game, but it does point to something that's an even deeper issue, which is the system is so broke internally that they have to resort to that kind of chicanery. Well, it's interesting, Bert, we have the world kind of sitting in two camps right now. One sees recovery being just around the corner, and later this year we'll see positive earnings, and that will warrant a massive move higher in equities, ergo you should buy assets while they're cheap. Then the second group would say, no, there are reasons now to be concerned, but we do believe that central bank activity will be very active, ergo buy stocks before the announcement of quantitative easing. So you've got the investment community today, which is piling into equities, with the idea that central bank activity will be sufficient to keep this economic tsunami from hurting them. Is that advisable? What's your position?
Well, as you know, for every seller, it has to be a buyer and the other way around. And, you know, no one has the same opinion as everyone else. There's never a uniformity. My own view is this. I think the rally we've seen here since October 4th, which was the low, is one of expectations. Expectations that Europe will get its act together, that Europe will once again kick the can down the road. This LTRO that they did on December 1st was basically a 3-year, pushing the can down 3 years. The 3-year thing, and of course, after 3 years are over, the loans, you know, have to be reversed. They can extend it another 3 years. But eventually, it won't be enough money. And Christine Lagarde, the head of the IMF, said that today in Europe. And she was speaking to a group in Germany in the parliament, and she was warning of a collapse of Europe, which will bring about another great depression in the entire world. She warned about that. She said, we have to raise much more money. She's looking at $1 trillion in order to build kind of a wall around the system to prevent the collapse, because more problems are coming with Italy, Spain, Portugal, etc. Then Eastern Europe, we haven't even heard about Eastern Europe except for Hungary, but all of Eastern Europe, they owe over $1 trillion to the Western European banks, and nobody's really even talked about that. So there are huge problems over there. She's a very smart lady, and she is actually, you know, it's refreshing to hear someone in her position telling the facts, because usually these people always, everything is hunky-dory. She is really saying it the way it is. There is a global depression threatening. That doesn't mean it will happen, but it's threatening. And if the politicians don't get smarter, it will happen. And only the free market can resolve the situation. Free people, you know, as long as the governments of the globe continue to put up these impediments for people to start businesses and have a productive society, everything will shrink. And we see this like in Spain. They've got, what, under the young people, what is it, age group 18 to 28 or something like that, the unemployment is 44%. That's depression. Why is that, though? Because they have a law that anyone that a company lets go, you have to pay them 1 year's severance, okay? So if a company suddenly sees a big downturn in its business, they have to let go 100 people. They have to come up with a check to pay 100 people 1 year's worth of salary in advance. They don't have the money. So they can't do it. If they do it, the officers of the company go to prison. So obviously, under these conditions, no company will hire anyone.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com.
It is interesting because, I mean, that kind of an unemployment rate among youth, we've seen over 70,000 political, quote-unquote, incidents in China per year for several years now.
Yes.
Minor things, not all violent, but certainly small protests, gatherings, people saying we don't like this corruption, we don't like the fact that the local party boss is making out like a bandit, and meanwhile, we're still having a hard time feeding our families. It seems like if austerity defined the beginning of 2011, perhaps 2012 will be defined by popular anger. Would you see that as a trend in Asia, or we're not even limited to that, but maybe a global issue?
Global. That has been my point since the beginning of 2011. So 1 year ago, I said, we are going to go see increasing violence, upheavals, people rioting in the streets, and it will be global. And then came the Arab Spring, as they call it. I think it was actually the Arab Winter, because it's going to be a disaster for the Middle East. The radicals will take over. And so the entire globe is now in the uproar, and sometimes you wonder, is this really coincidental? Is it a sign of the time? Is it the pendulum, the long-term pendulum, swinging to one side? But this is so much like the 1930s. We know now what came out of the 1930s. It was not very good, what came out of the 1930s. We got a bunch of dictators and basically, you know, over 100 million people killed around the world by their own governments. So this is the kind of thing we could look forward to.
Look forward to, or just anticipate. We see major changes ahead, and apparently so do a few of the party bosses in China. You had mentioned in this report, a great report, if I might say so, 102-page report. One of the things you mentioned is that over the last decade or so, close to $120 billion has taken out of the country by the Makimaks, by the folks at the very top of the food chain in China. As they look at this, and perhaps that's a clue to us that this is a temporary thing, almost like glasnost and perestroika within the Soviet regime, there were periods of openness to Western ideas. They wanted to expand and bring in Western consultants to fix things, and we poured in money. And that's, in fact, what has happened over the last 20 to 30 years in China. But there's nothing to say that things can't turn around. If we see, and I mean negatively from a political standpoint, if, in fact, we see things deteriorate financially and economically, and we begin to see social unrest that cannot be controlled or contained, don't expect there to be regime change in a place like China. Expect the regime to dig in its heels and get pretty mean and nasty. And maybe that's a part of what you're implying.
Yes, they have, I don't know how many, tens of thousands of cameras in China, in the public squares, and et cetera. I remember last year we wrote about it in our Wellington letter. Government of China had ordered 500,000 closed-circuit TV cameras from Cisco, and they're going to be put in the public square. So the whole thing is, as soon as they see a group of people gathering, immediately the police comes and breaks it up. They cannot allow a small group of 10, 20 people develop into several hundred or several thousand people. So you're so right. You know, we saw that in Tiananmen Square. They don't fool around. They will not tolerate a revolution, and everything will be done to eliminate the revolutionaries. And it will happen. You know, it's really sad. And you just wonder, when is it going to hit the shores of the United States?
Do you think it will? Is that some reason? Do we have something to be concerned about there?
Well, we've got 46 million people right now on food stamps. So that kind of calms the water. At least the people aren't starving. But, you know, after a while, won't people get tired of not finding a job? You just wonder, how much will people accept? I really don't know. I don't have the answer.
Well, on the one hand, we've got bread, perhaps. On the other, we'll just have to introduce circuses, and that'll keep the people happy for a longer period of time. But these are still things that are end of Rome type stuff. It's not the kinds of things that portend a hopeful tomorrow and return to quick growth dynamics.
And you see, we don't have the limitations of many of the European countries, and their limitation is money. The government just can't fabricate the money out of thin air the way the Federal Reserve does. The Federal Reserve is different. They can create an infinite amount of new money out of thin air. And they did this, as we know now. The original number, the official number, was that they created $3 trillion for this financial crisis that we had. Then Bloomberg went to court, and over the objections of the Federal Reserve, the court said, no, the Federal Reserve has to disclose these numbers. So the first number that Bloomberg came up with was $7.7 trillion instead of $3 trillion. Then that amount increased. They started going through more of these 21,000 documents that the Federal Reserve had to deliver. I think it came out to about $18 trillion. And then we heard reports about $29 trillion was fabricated by the Fed. The Federal Reserve says, no, that's double counting, et cetera, et cetera. But whatever the number is, it's a huge amount of money that was created out of thin air. It used to be that they were limited in Washington by the amount of money that they could print on the printing press. Nowadays, it's all cyber money. It's created on the computer. They just add some zeros to the numbers. And so you can really create an infinite amount of currency and money at will. And therefore, gold and silver are absolutely, you know, a must investment for the next 10 years.
Perhaps you could contrast, though, we talk about China and an implosion in China. That does not communicate a positive message for industrial commodities. We may, in fact, see basic food commodities continue to rise in price just as a reflection of a greater number of dollars or currency units the world over chasing a stagnant amount of goods. What is the difference between raw materials weakness and precious metals strength? Where do you see those two diverge?
Yeah, you know, I look at commodities in three different areas. One is food. Okay, we have to eat. We have no choice. Okay. And therefore, you know, we're seeing fantastic supermarket inflation, as I call it. And many people, unfortunately, especially men, don't go grocery shopping. I make it a point that at least once a month, I want to go to a supermarket and see what's happening to prices. And it's just absolutely incredible. I see price increases of 30, 40, 50% and more in just 6 months. Okay, so this will continue. The other area of commodities is raw materials, iron, ore, zinc, aluminum, etc. They will be very dependent on economic activity. As economic activity declines, the prices will decline. Copper, many people call it Dr. Copper because copper is supposed to be a good indicator of economic activity. It really isn't because it's manipulated by China. The government of China, they also know that everyone looks at copper, so they buy a lot of copper. I think imports of copper in December into China were at a record high, okay, after having been in the slump for a number of months. But the Chinese government says, okay, well, buy a whole bunch of copper, and then everybody thinks everything is wonderful over here. So that's the second area. The third area is a store of value commodity, and that's gold and silver. And I think more so silver, although a lot of people, you know, they say, well, silver is an industrial metal, and therefore it will decline when demand declines in a recession. But you also have to look at the other side, and that is that silver is the affordable store of value. Gold at, you know, $1,700 an ounce is not that affordable for most investors. And if you want to go, you know, let's say everything gets really bad, like in a Weimar Republic, you can't very well buy a loaf of bread with a gold coin, you know? But you might be able to get that loaf of bread with an old silver dollar. And this is what's important. And I remember that from Germany in the 1940s. And after the war, after 1945, the German currency was worth nothing. And the stores, the grocery stores, were virtually empty. But if you had one of the old silver coins, you went into the back room, and there were groceries, and there was food that you could buy, okay? So nobody wanted to accept the paper currency. So I think silver actually has a good story at this point.
Yeah, I would agree. And it's interesting, the old bags of dimes, quarters, and 50-cent pieces, 90% silver content, they're trading with virtually no premium today. And at times, you know, going back to 2008, where demand was very high for those silver bags, the premiums on those bags got to even 20-25% over the spot price.
Yeah.
Today, it's right at spot. I mean, there is no premium in terms of local domestic demand, and prices are significantly off their peaks. We're about $32, $33. Anywhere from, I'd say, $28 to $32 makes sense, maybe even $33 or $34 on the high side if someone's taking an initial position. But yeah, this is an interesting period of time where there is themes of deflation on the one hand, and you know we are talking about a tremendous amount of deleveraging if there is a collapse in China, you know, on the one hand, but as you say, a store of value, how do you preserve what you have in a world where all of your currencies are fiat-based? Since 71, this is the first time in world history that we are on an entirely fiat-based system. It doesn't matter if you're European, it doesn't matter if you're an Asian, it doesn't matter if you're an Australian, a Canadian. You are looking at your own domestic currency, and it's backed with paper promises. It's backed with political promises. It's backed with potential tax revenues, but that's the only good part. And the bad part of that is it's just coming from us to support the currency. So nothing really good there in terms of just the old reliable store of value. Let me ask you a question, because this is something that many have speculated on. Is there the possibility of returning to a gold standard? What would the Federal Reserve have to become, or would it just simply have to go away, for the gold standard or a discipline like it to come into our money system again?
Well, yeah, that's a very good question. You know, something that's been debated since I remember the last gold bull market in the late 1970s. I think it'll take an absolute crisis of confidence where people will not accept paper money. And then the government will have a choice. Do we compel, do we force people to accept paper money? Do we have prison sentences on people who use something else as a medium of exchange? And, you know, if you read the history of the last several thousand years, you will see that whenever a country exceeded spending to buy what they produce with coins, they started cheating on their gold coins. They put less and less gold and more tin or zinc, other metals into it. And then pretty soon people would not accept the money. Then the countries would issue a law, okay, death under penalty of death, if you don't accept our official money, you know, you will be executed. That's one alternative that governments can take. It's not a very good one. The other alternative is where they say, no, we can't do that. We have to reinstill confidence in our currency. And that means a gold standard. And right now, if you take the old way that they fixed gold at $35 an ounce in the Bretton Woods Agreement in 1944, they took the monetary base of the United States. If we took the same measure today, the price of gold would have to be fixed up at about, I think, $9,200 an ounce. And I think eventually that is probably what will have to happen. It's not going to happen this year or next year. But eventually, the problem is we are now riding up an exponential curve. This is going to be a parabola. And many people don't agree with that view. But when you take the power of a compounding, you take any compounding curve, it's unsustainable, you know, and until it finally collapses. If you take, there's one good example, compounding. If just at 1%, okay, you take a 1% annual compounding rate. Egypt, 3,000 years ago, let's say it had 3 million people. If the population in Egypt had compounded at a 1% annual rate, Egypt right now would have 27 trillion people living there, okay? Trillion, not billion, okay? So that's an amount of people that you can't even imagine. Okay, that's just a 1% rate. Do you know that the global debt is now running at a compounded annual growth rate of 11.2%, 11 times higher? This is unsustainable. We are now reaching the point where that parabola is accelerating upward. If you take, for example, a pond, one, there you've got one lily there, and the lily reproduces and doubles every day, okay, until the entire pond is covered. Do you know that 2 days before the entire pond is covered, only 25% of the pond is covered, 75% is not? This is what happens when compounding just really starts accelerating. And this is happening across the globe. What they're doing in Europe right now is going to be accelerating this compounding growth rate because they're going to bail out Greece. They're going to fabricate more artificial money, billions, hundreds of billions of dollars, and it will not resolve the problem. It just accelerates it.
So it appears that the debt problem and this credit excess is at the root. And as you said, when we started our comments today, many of these things would be solved by the market, but the market solution is not necessarily a pleasant one because there are no favorites in the market. You come with your own merits, and if you don't have them, then it can be scathing and painful. That's the nature of bankruptcy.
That was the message of von Mises. He said, you know, if there's a credit bubble that bursts, a credit bubble produced by the central bank, and it bursts, and it is not allowed to cure itself, meaning defaulted loans, etc., and they try to prevent that by creating another bubble, it leads to much greater pain in the long run. And this is where we are. They chose to intervene in 2009, just really pump it up, step on the accelerator, fabricate trillions of dollars of artificial money. So they chose the route that von Mises said should not be taken, and it will lead to a much greater catastrophe down the road. That's where we are.
Well, we hope that with that greater catastrophe comes some sanity or a return to sanity as people try to hash out what is responsible for the demise. And hopefully it's not capitalism that's blamed for it, because this kind of intervention is anything but capitalism. Cronyism, certainly. Yeah. Crony capitalism, if you even want to borrow the word, but I think that's getting dangerously close. The free market has not been allowed to operate and function the way it would ordinarily for probably 30 or 40 years.
Yeah.
Central bank intervention being there at every downturn to prop things up and move them forward, essentially eliminating the business cycle.
But David, see, you're talking about hope. And as we all know, hope is not a very good investment tool. And studies, there's a study I just read this weekend, basically that says that they found that when conditions worsen, people demand more governmental interference in the free market system. Okay, I think we've reached that point where everyone is getting poorer, and now people will look to the government for their salvation. And that means more intervention in the free market system, which worsens the problem. It doesn't create. So this pendulum has gone to the wrong side, and I think it'll take a long time. And hope is not good enough. I think it's people taking an active role in what's going on and educating themselves of what's going on. There are a lot of smart people in this country, but there are a lot of people also that don't think it's important to know what's going on. And they trust their politicians to do the right thing. And maybe that's not the right way to go.
Well, we'll see that trust tested again as we come into 2012, and we'll see if it's actually warranted as we move into 2013 and 14. Regardless of the party, they've got an uphill battle, and we wish them the best, but realistically, don't think that either party will have many solutions given the gravity that they're now having to fight. It's a natural force, and trying to suspend these natural laws are quite challenging.
Absolutely, and you know, what we painted a pretty gloomy picture here, okay? And so this is not something you go out now and you short the heck out of the stock market. That doesn't mean that at all. I think, you know, if you look at the shorter term, there's a lot that can be done by the government. Let's face it, they make the rules. They have the printing press. They can do a lot in an election year. And, you know, there's a chart, a compounded chart of the last, I think, since 1928, in an election year, what happens to the stock market. This is very important. So they take all of these years, all these election years, they put together every month what the performance is. They add it up. And what this chart shows is that from now for the next 5 months, the market should be going down. Okay? And then comes the period of 5 months before the election, and the market soars upward. And that's what all presidents do in order to get reelected. You know, they love that job, not because of the salary, but I guess it has good fringe benefits. So this is something that the bears should be aware of. You know, there's going to be big rallies sometime this year. And in the stock market, there should be a correction first, but don't go overboard on the short side. That's my view at this point. And those views are always ready for a revision when the technicals call for it.
Well, good. We'll look forward to having you back on the program and getting as things develop in China and certainly as the technical picture changes. So thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you very much, David. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
Well, Dave, as always, it's a great conversation with Burt Doman, and I know that you know, you're taking away an awful lot of information right now from the other people who were on the panel there with The Economist as well. But there were a couple of key indexes right now that are sort of proving Burt's point that things are slowing down.
Well, certainly. His mention of the Baltic Dry Index and the Harpex Index as well, these are two separate measures of what it costs to move goods from one place to another.
Right.
They're in extreme decline. And you wouldn't see that in the context of a robust recovery in exports. So the real question, and this goes back to a conversation we had with Stephen Roach over a year and a half ago, can they make the transition from being externally oriented in their economic growth generation, or are they moving towards an internal consumption-oriented society and economy?
Well, that's true. China has been a model that's worked very, very well as long as the West has worked very, very well. We worked very well because we could borrow money, and we spent our borrowed money over there. They grew. They, like Bert said, they used our technology. They don't invent things themselves. They used our technology. They used our borrowed dollars, and they recycled them back. But hey, we're not borrowing right now. We're not spending right now.
And so, guess what? They're not actually moving towards a consumption-oriented society right now either. At least the statistics don't bear that out. Moving a decade ago from 45% of their economy being oriented toward internal consumption to now 34%. That's a critical thing because that's the transition they need to make. As you look at this major migration from the countryside into the cities, there's only one thing that they would be moving to the cities for, Kevin,
right,
and that's jobs. So if they don't have an expanding workforce, and again, that's either service-related to service themselves or export-related, and that is servicing Europe and the United States, these are the issues that we have in play. We don't think they have what it takes. They may be anticipating this internally-oriented economy, but that could be 15 to 20 years out. Our question, and I think Doman's was well asked, what happens to the infrastructure that you've built as it goes unused over the next 10 to 15 years? They're already having problems with their rail system, and it's not even a year old.
David, this reminds me of like a water skier. Okay, a water skier is not powering himself. He may be flying through the water at 40 or 50 miles an hour, but it's because there's a boat that's pulling him. Now, we have been the boat, America and the West, for China. And we have been pulling them, and everybody's been going, look at China. They're going 40 or 50 miles an hour. Look at that. They're staying on top of the water. But until they can become the boat themselves, they really cannot have a self-enclosed economy that can support itself. Is that right?
That's correct. And I think one of the things that we can walk away as we close the show today, Kevin, is this social dynamic where people are buying gold because they know that they need to take care of themselves in the future, and they don't have an adequate safety net. They don't have a social safety net, whether it is a health care or health service related safety net, or even something like Social Security like we have here in the United States.
Yeah, you're talking about the Chinese. The Chinese don't have those things that actually have been promised to Americans that are questionable here in America now again. But for them, they never had it in the first place.
So will there be the introduction of some sort of a social safety net within China that will unlock the savings of the Chinese, which are currently going into gold and frankly have no reason to stop in the context of an understated inflationary problem in the country? Will there ultimately be a transition to internal consumption on the basis of a reorientation of savings because of what the government has put in place in terms of their spending programs to the benefit of society, like our Social Security programs and things of that nature? That's what we can look forward to at the end of 2012, to look back and say, Was there anything fundamentally changed that was impactful to that social fabric in the dynamic that has people knowing that they have to take care of themselves and thus oversave because they don't have any other way of taking care of themselves in the future?
So, but what you would say for now, Dave, for the investor who's looking at China as an engine of growth, you would say, no, keep your money at home. Let's see what happens. And we'll have guests on that will continue to cover this subject matter over the next year.
That's correct. I would say we've just got to keep our eyes and ears open.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Burt Doman. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or you can always give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.